Welcome in, latest episode of That SEC Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Bratton. Go by SEC Mike on them Twitters. And there he is, our great friend, Stephen Lassen, senior editor over at Athlon Sports. Merry Christmas, Stephen. How are you?
Merry Christmas, Mike. Merry Christmas to you and all the cousins. I am still angry at the College Football Playoff Committee, but I am also very excited to talk some playoff games and talk some other things in the great world of college football, my friend.
Yeah, no doubt. So, man, it's, you know, the portal doesn't even open, Stephen, for like 2 or 3 weeks, but good luck telling that to all these quarterbacks and some key players around college football, because that thing is spinning out of control already. We got an epic weekend. I'm always used to, Steven. I don't know if you're used to this yet, but we used to have a college football season, and then we had like a quiet 3 weeks to a month, and then we'd get bowl games. But now that they've expanded this playoff, you just look around the corner and the playoff, it's so weird. We get these marquee games everybody's dying to watch, and before a lot of these middling bowls, it's kind of backwards how they do it.
Yeah, it is. It's weird. I mean, you probably remember this when they had like the BCS. There was like the buildup of all those games. Like you get your Holiday Bowl, you get the Chick-fil-A Peach Bowl, and then you'd get the Sugar Cotton in the national championship game. And here we are. The bowl season just kicked off on Saturday. We got a couple during the week. And here we go. Friday night, a big game in Norman and 3 games on Saturday. So, I mean, Mike, I guess that, you know, we kind of gotten used to the 12-team playoff and sort of moved past like the pros and cons to it. I'm still like, I'm really fired up for these games on Saturday. Like, I think there's two of them that's going to be pretty good and two of them that might be on the side of blowouts. But it is going to be interesting as we, you know, move deeper into this era, because we get the home fields this week. We go to bowl sites. Like, you know, in the future, if we go to 16, what does that mean for the calendar? It's just one of like many things along with the portal and all this. There's a lot still going on in the world of college football. It's like, could we maybe shift the coaching and portal to like the off season and like concentrate on the games? But man, there is never a slow moment in the world of college football, right?
There isn't, Stephen. So we're going to get all into it. Stephen's going to preview these college football playoff matchups. He's going to provide a path for each and every SEC team to win the national championship. But before we get into that, the elite, the rest of us poors in the SEC, Stephen, our hopes is rely on the portal and new coaching hires and to get us to the college football playoffs. So a lot of news and notes all across the SEC. Before we jump into it, though, don't forget our great friends over at MyBookie, presenting sponsor of the show this football season. Go check them out, MyBookie.ag, promo code SEC, all kinds of deals this holiday season. And also our great friends over at Tennessee Legend Distillery, the official spirit of That SEC. If I wasn't sick, I'd down this whole bottle right here to show you what magical powers you could get from Tennessee Legend. So we appreciate them. But speaking of Tennessee, Stephen, let's start there first, because I've not talked a lot about this guy, because I'd be quite honest with you, I don't know a lot. I'm going to spend time in the offseason getting to know his defensive system. But you were the first one to let me know this was official, so shout out to you, Stephen. And I'm just curious to know your thoughts on defensive coordinator Jim Knowles getting hired at Tennessee. How does he pair with Josh Heupel, and what's your thoughts on the fit there?
Mike, you know, we talked last week in some of the other shows we've done about how Tennessee goes from right here to like right here. And if you were to poll people before this season, Jim Knowles was probably a top 5 defensive coordinator in college football. Now this year, for some reason, Penn State didn't work out. I think there was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. There are some criticisms of Jim Knowles and some cons, but I think if you talk about how Tennessee makes that jump, it's got to be on defense, getting back on track on that side of the ball. Tim Banks did a good job in 2024, not so much in 2025 in injury. So, Mike, I really like this hire. I think there are some things you can criticize Knowles for, but Tennessee took a big swing. Knowles was one of the best available out there, and they went out and got him. So I would be very curious to see how this meshes, because one of the criticisms of Jim Knowles has been that it does take a year or two for his defenses to get on track. Maybe he's not the most he could be maybe a touch grouchy at times, as some people like to say. But I think just in terms of marrying an offensive style like Heupel runs with a coordinator who is proven and can also do this kind of play good defense, because we saw this at Ohio State. You know, their offense was good. Heupel, you know, Knowles had to build a good defense. We saw it back at Oklahoma State. This was kind of in that Pete Gundy era where they were actually able to score points. They put the good defense out there. So I think, yes, there may be like a transition period, but I just think if you're talking experienced coordinators who've worked with offensive coaches who know how to put together a good defense, I think Knowles is really the kind of hire that Tennessee needs to make that defense take the step forward. So, like I said, certainly some concerns about the ramp up time, but I think in terms of big time hires, this is a good one for Tennessee.
Why do you think it takes a while for him to implement that defense? And considering I don't watch Penn State football or anything, but you know, if that was such an issue, you would think he would be wise enough to adjust. I don't know. What's your thoughts on all that?
That's a great question. I think some of it has just been maybe he's been criticized many times for being a little bit too complicated on that side of the ball. Maybe perhaps they could simplify it at Tennessee, because I don't think they necessarily need to reinvent everything. They weren't that bad last year, and of course all the injuries. So, and maybe perhaps the Penn State thing is like a learning experience too. The fact that they were supposed to be good on that side of the ball this year and gave up almost 6 yards of play in Big Ten games. Now, on the Penn State thing, Mike, I do think if you lose Abdul Carter, who's a first-round pick in the NFL draft, and you have some other injuries, like there's a reason why your defense probably didn't live up to the hype. But I think if you had to kind of boil this down of, okay, why is it taking so long? It's probably like maybe it's a little bit complicated for people to pick up. There's an adjustment period. Also, I think, like I said, Knowles' personality may not be the most like friendly from the outgoing, but he's like all ball. And so maybe that adaption period is really the biggest thing of why it's just so complicated. And that's kind of the biggest barrier, because I think if you're Tennessee, you're not saying we have 2026 to get this going. We have to get it going now. And so my kind of belief is like Heupel wouldn't hire a coordinator if he thought it's going to take, okay, 2 to 3 years. We've got to win right now. How do we do it? And somebody with this kind of experience can come in and maybe make some tweaks, start to put a system in, and you got a better defense next year. So I think that's kind of the optimism route you want to play for Tennessee.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen, but I believe Jim Knowles did not bring any assistants with him to Penn State other than maybe an analyst or two from Ohio State to Penn State. And if that's accurate, do you think it'd be wise for him to, or at least maybe Heupel, let him kind of hire who he wants to hire on the defensive side of the football to speed up the implementation at all?
It's a good question, because if you're bringing in a coordinator of like Knowles and his track record and sort of longtime leadership, you kind of have to trust, or at least you know that he's going to blend in well with the guys they have. And you're right. There was no on-field coaches that followed him, like on the main, you know, 10, 11 guys from Ohio State. Now, if you go back to the Ohio State national championship team, there was like apparently some friction on the defensive staff about what they want to do as far as schematics and all that, because they remember that lost to Oregon, and then they turned it around in the second half of the season. And so perhaps there was a little bit of friction there. Maybe he didn't mesh with the guys after they had kind of that midseason loss. So you wonder, could that come up at Tennessee? But, you know, I think, again, if you're bringing him in and you move that fast to hire somebody like this, you have to feel confident that, okay, our staff is going to mess with him. He's going to mess with the returning guys. I still think, yeah, you probably bring in somebody or two, whether it's an on-field, off-field assistant to help speed that up. Because you can hire more coaches now, you know, that just makes sense to where you can hire like an assistant linebackers coach or secondary coach. So I guess it wouldn't stun me if you see maybe a couple guys follow him that have experience in that system.
Right. And then I apologize if I have the timeline right here, but I was doing some research about Jim Knowles, and apparently Oklahoma, I believe under Brent Venables, tried to get him, and they could not because he was at Oklahoma State previously before Ohio State, if I have that correct. But the fact that apparently he's got the seal of approval of Brent Venables. I mean, that speaks pretty highly of Jim Knowles, wouldn't you say?
100%. I'm glad you brought that up. And I think one of the reasons why he went to Penn State was that it's kind of home. Like, he's from Pennsylvania. It was a chance to go home. Penn State had this opportunity to be the number one, number two team in the country. He was kind of seen as, okay, this defense for Penn State has been good, but last year it took a step back with Tom Allen. Now we go out and hire Jim Knowles. How do we take that next step? And so it's kind of similar to where Tennessee is at this point. So I think you're right. Like, Brent Venables has the seal of approval. He's been successful at stops that are hard, like Duke, Oklahoma State, to play good defense. He's good at Ohio State. Like, the track record is there. The seal of approval from other top defensive minds is there. The question is just how fast can he get this defense turned around? Some of that's personnel, and some of that will be scheme this year.
Mm. All right. Well, hey, speaking of scheme, they definitely needed a new scheme on offense in Columbia, South Carolina. And they got it, Stephen, with Kendall Briles. He's been in this league before, I believe, and you know, he's worked with Lane Kiffin. He's got a long track record, success at Baylor as well. What was your thoughts when Kendall Briles got announced as the new South Carolina offensive coordinator?
Mike, this is a massive, massive, massive upgrade from Marcus Satterfield and certainly from Mike Shula. I have not loved Shane Beamer's hires at offensive coordinator since he's took over the program, but I think this is a significant step forward for this offense. And one of the things that I like about this feels very much like moving more towards a college offense, right? You know, it felt like the goal has been in the past, like, we got to think about NFL schemes. How do we get Spencer Rattler prepared for the NFL? How do you do that for the Norris Sellers? Not saying that, you know, that can't be the goal still, but Briles has a track record of producing offenses that work. And so when you have a coordinator that has a track record of that, plus when you watch some of these offenses, it's very, you can tell there's a very, there's a way to, and kind of an almost an easy approach to offense. Like, we're going to take this 3 yards. It's not going to be hard. How do we build some easy throws, some easy runs into the scheme to help the quarterback? So I like that it's quarterback friendly. I like that it's worked in the SEC. I like that it's worked everywhere. Also, Randy Clements, the offensive line coach, has been with Briles pretty much everywhere. So you got a coordinator and an offensive line coach who are married together. And I think that'll help that scheme implementation quite a bit. Stan Drayton, also very good offensive assistant as well. So I just think in terms of the boxes checked, South Carolina is light years ahead of where they need to be, where they were last year and compared to where they will be this year.
Right. And it goes hand in hand, getting Lenore Sellers back for another year. That would be, I think, a massive retooling on offense without him. I think he's the one, you know, it's kind of Captain Obvious, but he's the one I think that stands to benefit the most for playing in this system. We saw what happened to KJ Jefferson when he was with Briles, and then when they transitioned him to Dan Enos, we had to answer angry emails to you know, that was so bad. But just the fact that Lenore will be playing in this system, tempo, and I don't know about you, Stephen, but I've always believed that Sellers thrives kind of in the, I don't know how you describe it, but basically, like, almost like schoolyard football, to where, yeah, play breaks down, he can beat you still, and that's a lot of times that's what you're going to get with tempo, is you're going to catch the defense napping or maybe misaligned or running a player on and off the field, and I think in those situations, I think that suits Sellers to a T, because he'll either push the ball down the field or he'll break a big long run. I think this is a match made in heaven for Sellers as well.
Yeah, the first thing that I saw, or the first thing that I thought about when Briles was connected to South Carolina, my mind immediately went to the success that KJ Jefferson had with Briles, because, not saying they're similar players, but there's a similar kind of style offensively with the mobility and maybe the ability to push the ball downfield. And I thought about that and thought, okay, you got the mobility, like, maybe Sellers gets his confidence back as far as a runner, being able to take off there. Like, if there's that go is back in the offense, then you get the deep balls and then you can take the easy throws. Like, it's an offense that's like it feels very college, and it's almost like a boring, you know, way to describe it, but it feels like they've tried maybe offenses that were too complicated, play callers that were out of their element, and this time it feels this is the right fit for we've got to get better right away. You know, you can't have another 4-8 season. So how do you get better right away? You go and get a coordinator who's got a track record of success in the SEC and college football, and you marry that with a quarterback who's eager to improve, to make a point for the NFL. But that system, not only one, has a track record of being good, it can get better right away. So I think you have that rapid improvement, and you put Sellers in place. Like if you're a South Carolina fan, I think you have to be really excited about the start that you've had this offseason. You've got a better offensive coordinator, better direction on offense, and you've got your quarterback back. That's a good – all those are major steps forward from where they ended the season.
Right, and the schedule sets up quite well for them next season, Stephen, to have a lot of success. They typically start a little slow under Shane Beamer, but next season with Kent State and Towson back-to-back home games to open – before getting Mississippi State again at home, you know, there's a real opportunity to get off to a great start here, I would think.
Yeah, I agree, Mike. I mean, you could easily see them being, 4-1, maybe, before you get to the Florida game. Obviously, Mississippi State was a lot better this year. I suspect they will be next year. Not totally sure what we're going to get out of Kentucky with the new coaching staff, but if that offense gets off to a fast start, you could easily see them beat Mississippi State and Kentucky. You're sitting there 4-1, and then you get into the tougher part of the schedule, maybe with Florida, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Clemson on the road. And you get a couple top 25 teams there with Tennessee, Texas A&M, and Georgia. But I think at minimum, with Sellers coming back and Briles in place, like a bowl game has to be the bare minimum for this team next year. And otherwise, I think the changes are probably a lot more significant than OC.
Right. And then, Stephen, I didn't ask you this in advance, so if you don't have any thoughts on it, that's completely fine. But I just realized since we last spoke, they released the 26 schedules, to which we have all the graphics for. Did anything jump out to you from the SEC schedule release, or maybe you're so entrenched in this season, you've not taken a deep dive on them yet?
I have to admit, I have been so caught up in the coaching carousel. Thank you, Michigan, for that late surprise last week. But I think that the game that, Mike, that I have circled already is just LSU and Ole Miss with Giffen and all that drama. It's early in the season. You know, just getting those two teams with all the drama this year, I think that is going to be a fun early season matchup. You could already see like game day probably penciled in there. Also, very much looking forward to Texas and Ohio State early in the season. Those are probably two of your top 10 teams in the preseason. Also thinking about Texas at LSU next year too, getting Arch potentially against LSU and Kiffin. So there is, Mike, in the big picture, I think my biggest takeaway from the schedules has to be the looming bloodbath that is going to be 9 games in the SEC, because if the playoff committee did not take into account strength of schedule, adding a 9th SEC game is going to make things even more difficult, where the losses are going to pile up. You add in all the coaching changes and the pressure. So I don't know about you, Mike, but some of these schedules, when you look at them and you're like, man, 10-2 is kind of like the new 11-1, right?
I think so. And the only other like overarching thought, and this had to have been done with a purpose, but nearly everybody has a schedule that they don't get back-to-back road games or back-to-back home games. Very few exceptions here. And if they do, it's because of they mix a bye in between. So I just noticed that after creating these schedules, or at least the graphics. I, of course, didn't make the schedules, but after creating the graphics, I just took note of that they did an outstanding job. Yes, these are all damn gauntlets, but again, almost 16 different teams. This is an impossible task, but they managed to do it, to kind of just mix and match all the pieces to where it's home and away, home and away, home and away for virtually every Southeastern Conference team, with just a limited examples otherwise. So in that regard, I think they I think they did it as fairly as they possibly could.
Yeah, that's a great observation, Mike, because with this 9-game schedule, there's that imbalance.
Right.
It's either 4 home games, 5 road, or 5 home, 4 away. And so it is very difficult, given that, to balance out the schedule. But the fact that, like you said, those bye weeks are dropped in strategically, or you don't necessarily have like those tough back-to-back road trips. There's no fair way in a 9-game SEC slate to make it fair for everybody, but those are kind of the tweaks that you can do to maybe minimize some of the wear and tear. Unfortunately for the SEC, it's also a season where there's only one bye week. I mean, given these schedules, you do wonder, get into November, how some of these teams might be beat up. Like, you're trading out a non-conference gimme probably for another SEC game. And some of these teams are going to be pretty beat up by November. So next year will be really interesting for the SEC. It's for sure.
Hey, speaking of interesting, shout out All Day Trey. Steven, he gave us $20. Thank you, All Day Trey. Steven and Marler's shows are completely polar opposite. Marler loves to agitate and get them wound up, and Steven gives reassurances and keeps fans calm. Either way, love them both. Go Dogs. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas, Trey. Appreciate you, buddy.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, Trey. I appreciate that. Yeah. Marler's shows are probably a lot more interesting, right?
I guess he's off the handle, to put it mildly. I mean, he's fighting with the commenters. I ask him something, he'll start saying something, then he's like reading what they're saying about him. I should turn the comments off, if not for their hilarity, or at least make it to where he can't see them. You know what?
Yeah. Mike, I will tell you, and this is kind of like a dirty little secret, it's really hard to like pay attention to the comments and like talk at the same time. So I have to read the, I'm trying to read the defense and read the coverages, and you know, the helmet comms are going off. So, appreciate all the cousins for commenting and hanging out as always.
Absolutely. Well, all right. There was another one I wanted to ask you about, Stephen. This is to my knowledge and to your knowledge, we talked about this off air, not official as far as we know, but it's been widely reported and no clue. Maybe they're just trying to finalize the contract. I don't know. But it has been wildly reported that Arkansas is hiring defensive coordinator Ron Roberts. What would be your thoughts on Ron Roberts joining the Silver Field staff?
Mike, this feels very solid. I don't know necessarily that the upside is one of the best defenses in the SEC. But given where Arkansas has been this year on defense, it does feel like this at least raises the floor for next year. He's been a defensive coordinator in the SEC at Auburn. He's been at Florida. He's also been at Baylor. You know, even going back to Louisiana, his defenses in the Sun Belt were solid too. So I don't know that you're looking at a coordinator who's going to get this defense to be the number one in the country. But if anything, there's experience in the SEC, experience overall, and also kind of a track record of putting together pretty solid groups. So maybe the upside isn't there, but for a team that's got a lot of issues on defense and you need to get better right away, I don't think you can take a gamble on somebody. I think you got to go get somebody with some experience who can turn this thing around quickly. So I think it's pretty solid. And I think also you can tell by Silverfield's comments, I know it was kind of like a off-the-cuff meeting with like Calipari and just saying like, we're going to play defense and, you know, paraphrasing a bit. This side of the ball is going to be a focus and trying to turn it around. So that's what would give me some comfort if I'm an Arkansas fan, is there's an experience factor there.
Right. And for anybody that, you know, missed some of this train wreck that was Florida season. So he was the defensive coordinator last year. I don't think they lost the South Florida game because of defense. I know they didn't lose LSU with the 5 interceptions because of defense. I think they won the Texas game thanks to their defense. The Mississippi State game, they made a critical interception. Georgia, they held their own. So just the point being, I know Florida's season was a disaster, but I'm not putting that on the defense or Ron Roberts.
I agree with that, Mike. Certainly, I think the biggest flaw for Florida this year in its season was offense. And I think if you're a Florida fan, you probably were throwing things at your computer last week when you read that Billy Napier was going to hire an offensive coordinator at James Madison, right? But I think given where the offense was, you know, it's hard to pin all that on the defense, and it's tough to play good defense. Like when you're on the field and you can't, and the offense is not sustaining drive. So given how the defense turned things around late last year too, I think that's kind of why it's like, this doesn't feel like a home run hire necessarily. It probably won't make like the 10 or 15 best, but at the same time, there's a really solid baseline I could see this coming out to for Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, and speaking of Florida, DJ Lagway to the transfer portal, seeing a lot of reaction from that, obviously, big name quarterback who obviously didn't live up to the hype this year. But what's your thoughts on that? Is that, and is that even a, we don't know who the quarterback will be at this point in time at Florida, but there's a good bet it's not a downgrade given how he performed.
Mike, today was moving day in the portal because you had DJ Lagway, you had Dylan Raiola, you've had some others enter the portal, potentially Brendan Sorsby at Cincinnati. So it is the portal is starting to churn. And I would also, I think for anybody who has anxiety about the quarterback situation at Florida, I would just keep in mind that 50 to 60% of teams are going to start a transfer. They started a transfer this year. That data from 24 to 25 was pretty consistent. It's not going anywhere. So I wouldn't freak out if I'm Florida, Mike, for a couple of reasons. Number one, the offense was not very good. It was up and down. I think Lagway being hurt obviously played into that. But with the quarterbacks that we've already seen in the portal, the ones that are going to be in there, I kind of trust that John Summerall and Buster Faulkner, they're going to figure this out. So I was a little surprised to see this departure, but I can also see that maybe they want, you know, they'll bring in their own guy. And certainly I think based upon some of that reporting from CBS, it does feel like there's a standard being set there by the new staff that everyone's going to have to, I guess, live up to. Is that fair?
Yeah. And if anybody that missed it, go check it out. I retweeted it, but basically they don't reveal who said it, but I think it was DJ Lagway's dad, if I had to guess. With the comments provided, but basically they just, you know, they made it be known, hey, DJ wanted to come back, you know, but assurances weren't made, yada yada yada. So again, I don't know if that was his dad or not, but it certainly sounded like Steven said, where you're gonna have to earn it. You know, they kind of question I read it as his. How tough he is literally how I read it. But it doesn't say that, but that's how I read it. And he entered the portal. So how tough is he? I don't know. I wish him the best. I think had he not gotten injured, I think DJ Lagway could be one of the stars of college football. And I hope that's what he becomes at his next stop. But I don't think it's going to be in Gainesville.
Could it be LSU?
Yeah, perhaps. I don't think he fits what they want to do either. I really don't.
I think there's almost there's two thoughts I think with Lagway. Like if I was a team that needed a quarterback, perhaps like an LSU, I think the upside is certainly there. Still a lot of talent, but also I think what we've seen on the field so far is a very small sample size of it working out. I think it will at the next stop, but I do think it's going to be interesting to see the list of suitors. And then also he is going to be probably one of the biggest X factors next season in the SEC or wherever he goes, because of what we've seen on the field so far. There's a lot of potential. He's been banged up. How does he go to the next stop and quickly acclimate given all of what's happened this year? So much like this year, he was one of the X factors. I bet he's going to be that way next season and trying to figure out what level of play he's going to give his next team.
Hey, what was your thoughts on Ole Miss offensive coordinator, their new offensive coordinator hired Joe David Baker?
Mike, this is going back to the well, basically. So he was on the Ole Miss staff in 21, 22, and 23. And then he left to be the offensive coordinator at East Carolina the last 2 years. So I think from a fit perspective, like this makes a ton of sense. You get a guy who's been in your system, he's been in your program before, and now he's had a chance to call plays at a pretty good team. East Carolina's offense was good this year. And also a lot of mix and match parts. Transfer quarterback that got better. A lot of transfer receivers. Like they had a lot to kind of jumpstart this group. So that group got better under his watch. And he's got experience in your program. So obviously the challenge from going from the American to the SEC is a lot higher, but I think somebody who's been there and has experience, that makes a ton of sense. It seems like it's a seamless kind of transition from Kiffin, Weiss to Baker. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, it's a play for continuity for sure. Yeah. So we're kind of going all in there at Ole Miss. That'll be interesting to see how that plays off, but it'll be interesting, Stephen. I mean, I think if they messed with what was working, I think he'd be criticized. So I think that's probably the smart play. We'll see if it's the right play post-Kiffin era.
Mike, I think one stat that stood out to me about Baker's tenure at East Carolina, they were 28th this year in offensive success rate. It's top 30 offense. That's pretty good. Also, one of the things, and I mentioned this before, anytime a defensive coordinator gets hired as a head coach, I always worry about their offensive coordinator hire because some of them go too cautious. They go too conservative. They don't want to put any extra stress on a defense. Well, I think this is a good move by Pete Godin. It kind of reassures me about some of the direction. It's not just going, okay, let's go with somebody unknown because they might play a little bit to defense. No, you're getting a guy who's been using some tempo. And like I said, he's got the past experience in the system. He's not necessarily a cautious hire. So I like that move from Pete Golding. That kind of tells me that it seems like his head's in the right spot of how to direct this program.
All right. How about A&M? This kind of raised my eyebrows, Shane, Stephen, but I don't know about you. With Colin Klein leaving to be Kansas State's head coach, today, Coach Elko announced Holloman Wiggins, the receivers coach, is going to be the new coordinator. And I don't know that he's got any offensive coordinator experience, and certainly think Colin Klein did a good job for A&M this year. What's your thoughts on this?
I think it's a play, much like we talked about with Ole Miss, like it's a play for continuity. Because you're taking somebody who's been your receivers coach. He's been in the program the last couple years and trying to just say, here's the scheme, here's the playbook, let's put a couple tweaks on it and we can keep this thing going. Probably makes some sense too with Marcel Reed coming back, like not making wholesale changes. The voice on the headset's not going to change a lot. I will say, this is curious to me because I think if I was in Elko's shoes, obviously Wiggins has been good at receiver. I would like somebody with a little bit of play calling experience here as well, because he has not called plays before. I would like somebody who's been a high level coordinator to step in and take Marcel Reed's game to the next level. Cause you're probably going to have some turnover at receiver, I would imagine, with some NFL guys. It's a little curious to me. It is just a straight play for continuity and trying to keep things going. It may work out. I do think it does concern me a little bit that he doesn't have play calling experience. Is that fair to say?
Oh, I think so. Especially when you got a defensive minded head coach, you know, that's turning it over to an assistant. Now, I have heard they're hiring. I don't know the guy's name. I forgot it, but they're hiring another offensive coach essentially that's got a long track record of play calling. So,
Is that Brad Cornelson?
Yeah. So
okay. Don't look at his offensive stats.
But if we got to hire an offensive coordinator for the offensive coordinator, I don't know. That's Billy Napier-ish when he hired Ron Roberts to coach Austin Armstrong. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not on board with that.
Yeah, this one strikes me. The move to promote him to OC, and I guess it's he may be ready for this job. I guess from the outside. When you're handing somebody at a high level program in the SEC the keys to the offense, and given how successful you were, I think I'd like to have a little bit more experience, or not having to hire somebody to coordinate the offensive coordinator. It struck me as I thought A&M would go out and hire somebody to fill this role, but I can also see the other side of it is, hey, Elko's in the building with this guy. He trusts him. It should be seamless from a scheme perspective. You've got your starting quarterback. You just try to keep it going for next year. That may work. I also do worry about what happens if the offense bogs down, a first-time play caller, how do you get out of it? Colin Klein did a really nice job over the last 2 years. There's going to be a lot of pressure on him right away to get this offense to another level next season.
Now, how about Kirby Moore exiting Missouri, Stephen, where a lot of Missouri fans are happy to see his ass go. But, you know, how much is that? They didn't have a quarterback. the offensive line was not great. And last I checked, Stephen, Missouri turned a real corner when they brought in Kirby Moore. So, you know, you can split it both ways. The offense underperformed, coordinator got to go. But to me, what this really does, Stephen, this is a huge offseason for Missouri. And they have a huge question mark at quarterback. Bo Prabula, Matt Zollers, do they go transfer? Well, before they even get that resolved, they got to find an offensive coordinator. And this is a fascinating offseason here in Missouri. What's your thoughts on this situation?
It almost feels like Tennessee to some extent. You know, we talk about, okay, they've been here the last couple seasons, you know, winning those double digit games, finishing perhaps in the top 25 this year. But how do you go from that to being a playoff contender next season? And I think that's the question that it's going to be fascinating for with this hire from Missouri. Is there an internal option? Is it Drinkowitz maybe being the play caller again? Do they go out and get somebody? And so I think if I'm a Missouri fan, I'm sitting here going, go out and get somebody. We were 45th in the country this year in success rate. Obviously, they were pretty good at running the ball. They got to figure out the quarterback. It kind of just goes to, this has been good. This has been good. I know they're not everything I saw about Washington State hiring, there felt like there was a Missouri fan or two saying, you know, good riddance, you know, not going to miss you. He's bad. They, like you said, Mike, they did turn a corner offensively with him. And if you're 45th in the country in offensive success rate, that's pretty good. And so with the quarterback injuries and some of the stuff that happened with Brady Cook the year before, you know, to get to 8, 9, 10 victories is a pretty good season. So I would like to see the next, and I think this is the key. I think if I'm Drinkowitz, it's like, go out and get somebody who can go from being here to here. And so that's the challenge for Missouri as a whole. And one way you do that is to hire an OC and not add any more weight to Drinkowitz's plate, because being the head coach, recruiter, all that stuff is a lot in this era.
Yeah. Anything else around the SEC pique your interest in recent days? And if not, maybe even just quarterbacks that have entered the portal outside of the SEC that you think could be a fit in the conference?
Mike, I think what's interesting to me is we're starting to get the early returns on roster construction for 2026. One thing that has been fascinating is to see the teams that are signing up their players for next year. Like, it's helpful for guys like me and you because it's like, okay, we know they're back for next season. But you're seeing that, like, not just in the SEC, you're seeing it like other programs. Like Maryland put out a statement saying, like, we've re-signed our quarterback, you know, for next season. So I think in this new era, we haven't finished 2025, but we're looking ahead and seeing, okay, who's coming back next year already? We got the draft. We got the portal coming up. You started to see a few names start to kind of make their way to the portal. And I think when you start looking at quarterbacks, you start looking at that 50 to 60% number of teams that will start a quarterback next year. You see Brendan Sorsby, you see DJ Lagway, you see Dylan Raiola. You're starting to get some heavy hitters in the portal. And so those may be like the top end kind of names that enter, but I suspect there's still going to be a solid second tier that starts to fill in. So I would keep my eye on, like, what does Oregon do at quarterback? What does Miami do at quarterback? And what does Texas Tech do at quarterback? Because those teams will probably impact some of the names like a Lagway, like a Raiola, Sorsby, some of these others as they try to find destinations and impact some of these SEC teams looking for a quarterback.
You know, I would think at some point Miami and Oregon got to develop a quarterback, but I guess maybe they don't, huh?
So, absolutely. I mean, it does feel like every offseason we go into now, it's Oregon and Miami and throw Texas Tech in there because they are willing to throw around some cash for a quarterback. But Mike, if you start making a list of like what the most fascinating quarterback spots are, like it's those, it's probably like what happens at LSU, what happens at Florida, Ole Miss and some of these other, Tennessee. It feels like the quarterback carousel is going to be pretty active in the next couple of weeks, and we're just getting started.
Yeah, no, I think that's completely fair. But hey, you know what's not fair, Stephen, is we've gone this long and we've not talked about the mighty Georgia Bulldogs, Stephen. The SEC champs, 12-1, So where better to start, Stephen, when we talk about teams that can win the national championship, the path for every SEC playoff team to win it all? I think we got to start with Georgia. Now, obviously, they've got the, I don't know if you want to call it the bye week, but they don't, they won't even play till we see Ole Miss and Tulane. Then we'll know their opponent. But what's got to happen for Georgia, you think, for them Dogs to be crowned national champions for the third time under Kirby Smart?
Mike, number one, I think there's a very good chance that we're talking in January about the Georgia Bulldogs winning a national championship. The other thing is, the first round bye didn't work out for those teams last year. So bye week, beware, I guess, as Georgia moves into this off week. I think the time off, though, is really critical given all the injuries that they've had. You know, CJ Allen's been banged up. We know Drew Bobo was banged up. Doesn't sound like he's going to be back. But the injury report late in the season, and this also goes to thinking ahead to future years and how difficult this 9-game SEC slate is. Like, by November, in a normal year, these teams are beat up. So I think just having the off week will help Georgia a lot as they try to go for this national championship. I think from the offensive side of the ball, let's assume that Drew Bobo's out. The good news is you've got a couple weeks to get the offensive line set, and it held up well in the SEC championship game. So you're already in better position. Now you've got a couple weeks to game plan around it. And I know this is a boring answer, Mike, but it feels like if Georgia just keeps doing what Georgia has been doing, which is run the ball, timely plays by Gunnar Stockton, let Zachariah Branch make a play or two. And then on defense, the way that they've been getting after the quarterback the last couple weeks, it feels like this defense and this team has turned a corner, but maybe it's they're finding their kind of the right switches at the right time and peaking when they need to. So in some respects, Mike, I think it's kind of one, the path for Georgia starts with they get healthy and they keep doing what they're doing. And it feels this team will travel well with the balance of offense and defense to face anybody in this playoff.
Right. And it wasn't that long ago, was it, Stephen, where a lot of these Georgia fans say, get that Glenn Schubin out of here. Now they got that defense firing on all cylinders. So they had a lot of young players playing this year, but this is starting. I was about to say that to look like Georgia of old, but maybe not quite, because that was just a historic run they had on the defensive front. But this is looking like, other than peak Georgia defense, this is looking like a traditional Kirby Smart defense. And that's kind of been the catalyst for this whole thing, don't you think?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think they've held their last, four opponents to 10 points or less. And we're talking Texas, we're talking Georgia Tech, we're talking Alabama. I know Charlotte's in there too, but that's pretty good on that side of the ball. And it also, what a switch it was from like earlier in the season when you watch like the Tennessee game. I mean, Tennessee was bombing this secondary early in the game. And if you would have told me on September 13th, that Georgia's defense would have rebounded, I'm not sure I would have, just based upon the way they were playing in the new pieces. But, you know, credit to Schumann, credit to Kirby Smart. As the season has gone along, those young players have gotten better. They figured out what's the right tweaks to up front. You know, they're not giving up as many big plays in the passing game. So front and the secondary playing better. And of course, it probably helps that they've kind of figure things out offensively too, is to kind of make that complete team as we come down the stretch of the season.
Yeah. Do you think it helps at all in a playoff scenario? Now, maybe it hurts them. I don't know. I'm curious to know what your thought, but there's not any like go-to necessarily. I know Branch, he probably is maybe that go-to, but there's not, I mean, Georgia could just beat you in so many different ways, right? So many different receivers, so many different running backs, tight ends, Gunner throwing or passing. Do you think it helps you in these playoff situations where, you know, defense got to be basically prepared to face anything and everything? Or because I could certainly see that being a plus, but I could also see it, you know, maybe sometimes in these playoff games, you know, this is where legends are made, right? Where you kind of, the opponent knows what you're going to do. You know what you're going to do. And it's player A's got to beat player B. and we find out for real who's a legend. What is the best path to winning it all, you think?
You know, it's funny you ask that, because I feel like if I'm Georgia, I could play the depth of the playmakers to an advantage. Because that way, let's just say if you get into a game against Ohio State, you take away Zachariah Branch, but now you got to contend with Dylan Bell. You've got the tight ends. You've got the running backs. And oh, by the way, Gunnar Stockton can hurt you with his legs. There's a lot there, but also you do wonder, okay, when it's clutch time, let's say Branch is taken away, is those weapons in the passing game on 3rd and 7 with the game on the line, are they going to step up? And I think that is a fair question. I also think what's also the one downside to this Georgia offense is, like, I love the efficiency and I love the play calling that Bobo has used at times this year. They don't hit big plays very often. And I think if you get into a game against Ohio State or Indiana or whoever it is, potentially in the national championship, I think you can bully ball your way into, you know, enough to win the game. But it would be a heck of a lot easier to win it if you could throw a 60-yard touchdown pass, as opposed to saying, okay, we got to put together 5-12 play drives that are going to be have to be super efficient and be perfect. I'd like to see a little bit more big playability out of this group. And I think maybe that gets at kind of the question here is, like, is Dylan Bell, London Humphreys, can somebody in one of these playoff games step up and make the big play? Because you know that everybody's going to be keen on Zachariah Branch. The depth is there, but when the moment is called upon, can someone do it?
Yeah. And then let's look at the bracket here just for Georgia's. Again, we're just keeping Georgia in mind here. Who is the if Georgia is to win it all, what will be the toughest game you think they have the entire playoff?
Mike, I think it's probably going to be the semifinal game against Ohio State in the Fiesta Bowl. I think Indiana, if they make it there, is going to be very difficult to beat. I think I think about raw talent on the roster, and Ohio State's one of the teams that can compete with Georgia in that regard. I don't think I want to see Ohio State there. I would much rather see like Texas A&M or Miami knock off Ohio State. And then I think Georgia becomes the favorite to win it all. Certainly not discrediting Indiana. I just think Ohio State's probably a greater threat to Georgia than Indiana.
Yeah. And then this is, again, probably just so obvious I shouldn't even ask it, but who would they prefer to play in the second round? Ole Miss, who they've already proven they can beat, or Tulane? They'd probably rather play Tulane, right?
Yeah, I think they would. I think in the big picture, though, Mike, Georgia has to feel pretty good about those second round matchups, because they've already beat Ole Miss, and if Tulane upsets Ole Miss, they're going to be a 17, 18-point favorite in that game, probably even more than that. So it feels like if you're Georgia, you're going, you know, we got to sit back and watch this game and see what happens. But we feel pretty good about the next round, and then we get to the Fiesta Bowl where maybe we get Ohio State. And then if we beat Ohio State, at that point, we're in the driver's seat to potentially win the national championship.
Well, I'll tell you, Stephen, who would win the national championship of giving cousins, and that would be Cousin Rick.
It's Texas A&M's biggest fan, Cousin Rick. Giggum Aggies.
Thank you, Cousin Rick. He gave us $50. Stephen just joined. I suspect we'll see more top-end players checking the market. I want to wish everyone and every cousin a very blessed and happy holidays. Thank you, Stephen. I have really enjoyed all your contributions to the show. Giggum, beat the hell out of Miami.
Thank you, Cousin Rick. I appreciate you. And happy holidays and Merry Christmas to you as well, my friend. Hope all the cousins are going to have a great holiday season. Hopefully, I meant to say this earlier. I meant to say, SEC Mike has got to be in heaven on Friday night with two SEC teams in a playoff game, right? That's got to be a good way to kick off your holidays.
Oh, yeah. So Shane and I, we're going to be doing a live stream. So we're going to be watching it with all the cousins that can't be at the game. So hope to, I hope you guys can log on and hang out with us for what a historic night that's going to be. You know what?
So your playoff experience is going to end after Ole Miss is to later done, right? No interest in the Oregon Jays Madison game, right?
I'll probably watch it, but I won't enjoy it. You know what?
Yeah. ex-SEC assistant Dan Lanning, right?
Yeah, I've got to scout who we're going to beat in the next round. You know what I mean?
Evan Stewart might be back for Oregon.
Oh, there you go. Hey, and shout out Tolkien. He gave us a $2 donation. Problem for Georgia is they got to play Ole Miss. Shout out Tolkien. And shout out one more time, Rick. What a giver. $5. Cousins, only 20% of those watching have hit the thumbs up. Smash it. Very Merry Christmas. Thank you, Rick, for the reminder for all the cousins out there. All right. How about path to the national championship, Stephen, for, let's do for Cousin Rick. How about Texas A&M, who, of course, faces Miami here on Saturday? What's the path to A&M winning it all?
Mike, I think the first thing about Texas A&M is how fired up I am for that matchup on Saturday. That is going to be an incredible scene in College Station to see Miami coming to College Station and the crowd and the environment. So I can't wait for that game on Saturday. But Mike, I'll go back to something that you and I talked about. I think Texas A&M is underseeded. I think they're a lot closer to five than they are, you know, seventh in the bracket. I think they got the short end of the stick on seeding. No surprise, because this committee sucked. But I think when it comes to like the path to the national championship, this is a very well-rounded team. And they can hurt you at the line of scrimmage with the offensive line, the rushing attack. Maybe Le'Veon Moss is back. That seems to be still up in the air. But I think they're strong right where you need to be, especially if you want to go against this Miami team. Miami's strength is in the trenches. Texas A&M's strength is in the trenches. Also, for the offense for A&M, if you can run the ball, that and you get Marcel Reed back on track. I think after the Texas game, I suspect we'll see him bounce back and play well against Miami. But those mistakes, like against Texas, were costly. Can't have that against Miami. I think we'll see a cleaner game from him on Saturday. But to me, that's the formula. Offensive line dominates. Reed plays well, and then on defense, you're doing the same thing. Trenches win out for A&M here, and then the pass defense continues to play like it has for most of the season. So I think the strength of A&M is kind of the parts here. They've got a well-rounded team, not a ton of glaring weaknesses. There are some areas that give you concern, but if one thing, if the passing game is taken away, it feels like they could just hand it off and they could really make some hay on the ground. So I like where this team is. And I think there ought to be some motivation based upon the way the Texas game played out that we see a much, much more focused and determined A&M team starting on Saturday.
Right. And obviously to make a run, Stephen, it's got to start with Miami. You got to get the first one if you're going to get the whole enchilada, as they say. But, you know, in terms of matchups, though, you let me know what you think. But I think this might, I have respect for Miami. Shane came on here yesterday and said, oh, they're going to beat them by 36, Mike. What are you talking about? No, I mean, I'm not out here saying that. I think Miami's got a lot of talent, particularly on the line of scrimmage. But I think this is of all the first round possibilities for A&M, I think this is one of the better ones they could get, because Miami is one dimensional on offense. It plays into the hands of Texas A&M's defense. And the fact that, you know, A&M can run the football really, really well. I think all that suits up well for A&M to have some success on Saturday. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do too. I think what's fascinating about this Miami team is they really don't run the ball particularly well for having a good offensive line. And, you know, for Carson Beck has been pretty good for the most part this year. He had that really bad game against Louisville. But I think one area, if I'm Texas A&M and when I'm watching on Saturday, Malachi Toney, the true freshman receiver for Miami, is one of the best playmakers already in college football. But if you take him away, I'm not sure that the other Miami receivers are going to be capable of consistently beating this defense. So to your point, you can kind of see how this game could play out is, okay, A&M's front, they can control the Miami rushing attack, but in passing downs, here comes Cassius Howe. Here comes this front. They're coming after Carson Beck. Maybe those other guys aren't getting open. They blanket Toney, and you could see Miami's offense kind of stumble here. So it is a clash in the trenches. And I think that's what makes this game really interesting. But at the same time, it's like you could chart your way through a pretty easy path for Texas A&M to come out on top.
And to your other point, Stephen, of this being an underseeded A&M team, which I would agree with you. I mean, we are not that far away, are we? You tell me if I'm wrong. I know they didn't finish the deal against Texas, but had they done that, you know, I was not really seeing much of a separation between them and Ohio State and Indiana for much of the year. And I know the metrics or whatever, I guess, suggested otherwise. But then again, last time I checked, Stephen, you could correct me again if I'm wrong. I didn't see Ohio State or Indiana go to Notre Dame. I didn't see them go through an SEC schedule. So my point is, I don't truly think there's like this massive separation between being a top four seed and where A&M is right now. I think they have all the pieces to make a big run. And perhaps my favorite thing about A&M is they can win a game in so many different ways. A high-scoring game, low-scoring game. They can come from behind. They can win on the road. They can, which is not ideal, but they can come back from 30-3. You know what I mean? Like, there's just, I don't know how many teams are capable of beating you four or five different ways, but I know A&M's one of them.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point. I think if I had to seed the teams in a tier, I think Georgia, Ohio State, Indiana are probably your top tier, and then Texas A&M would be like in that tier two, not that far behind the Georgia, Indiana, Ohio State mix. I think it's easy to say what ifs, but I think if they beat Texas and they make the SEC championship game, Mike, they're a top four seed. So the fact that they're sitting here at seven when they were undefeated for most of the year, yes, they have flaws, but everybody does. It seems like to me they're vastly, they should be closer to five than seven. And I think you're right. They can hurt you by just being a run team. They've got Marcel Reed's dynamic ability on the ground. I mentioned it earlier. I think we're going to see a much cleaner game from him on Saturday just because of what happened on Texas. They can hurt you that way. They can play good defense. So if you want to play the 20-17 game, and I'm sure Mario Cristobal in Miami would love to play that, they can do that. They can also play the 34-27 game. And so whatever wide range of possibilities are on the board, this is one of the teams in the playoff that I think is comfortable kind of playing any style. And as the loss can be a good thing and be a motivator, like we saw Ohio State right last year. Also think, you know, the South Carolina game and combined with Texas ought to show Texas A&M that if you're not locked in 100% every week, you know, you can have one of those kind of games and you easily get picked off. So there ought to be some motivation and a focus level from the end of the season that I think we see on Saturday for A&M.
All right. How about the path to winning it all, Stephen? For perhaps the most disrespected 11-win regular season team in SEC history, and I'm talking about them Ole Miss Rebels, so disrespected their damn coach left, that coward. But thoughts on Ole Miss, their path to winning it all, Stephen? And again, you on most years you'd say the sixth seed. What? Can they do it? Well, I mean, based on what we've seen this year, I think this sixth seed is more than capable of making a deep run here.
Mike, I meant to mention this with the bracket as a whole. I think what's unfortunate for some of these teams is they're all clustered in that bottom bracket because I mentioned Oregon and Texas A&M and Indiana is kind of, I think Oregon and Texas A&M are kind of like tier two national championship contenders. Indiana is tier one. It feels like that top half of the bracket is much more open to a team making a run. Whereas if you're in the bottom half, you got to go through Georgia. You got to go through Ohio State. Those teams have won national championships in the last couple of years. It feels like it's a lot tougher. But I think there's a path here for Ole Miss. And it starts with exactly what you said. Disrespect. Nobody believes that this team is going to make a run now that Lane Kiffin lives in Louisiana. There ought to be some motivation to prove that, yes, Lane Kiffin is gone, but this is still a good team. We still have the same players, the same roster. Nobody's opted out that's been public. They are locked in for this game. And I think what helps them is this game being at home, because the atmosphere in Oxford is going to be unbelievable, like it is at Texas A&M. But you have Pete Golding coaching his first game in Oxford in a playoff setting against a team you've already beaten this year. That is the perfect setup to get this kind of path to the national championship started. And if you win this game, you play Georgia, who you nearly beat a couple weeks ago. So the path for Ole Miss is like, yeah, you're in that bottom half, but it doesn't set up that bad, considering that it is a tough bracket, I think, given the circumstances.
Right, and so much energy spent on Lane Kiffin. Now that he's not there, you know, I would imagine there's a lot of desire within that locker room to go show the world that maybe Mr. Center of Attention should not have been the center of attention when it comes to the 11 wins that the Ole Miss Rebels just got earned on the field this season. So, you know, the opportunity to be kind of like an America's team for America to learn Trinidad Chambliss and Kewon Lacy and the crew, and a very opportunistic defense as well. And yeah, I mean, I think this sets up so well, being nearly a 20-point favorite at home, to kind of even if there are any speed bumps, I mean, you could screw up. They could screw up the entire first quarter, Stephen, and win by double digits. Like, I don't think that's, no disrespect to Tulane, but I think that's a fair statement, don't you?
It is, Mike, and I think one of the things we may see on Saturday is I think we may see Ole Miss actually get off to a really good start. You know, it helps that you've got Charlie Weiss and that staff still staying on to, you know, coordinate this playoff run. So you get all of that frustration from weeks. You know, it's Lane Kiffin, and now you get into the playoffs like, oh, yeah, they do have Trinidad Chambliss. They've got Kewon Lacy. They've got all these playmakers. Their defense is iffy against the run. Tulane's, you know, they're not exactly the most prolific rushing team. They can, you know, Jake Retzloff can hurt you on the ground, and they have some talent in the backfield. But as far as a matchup goes for your first one, this one, like, everything checks off in a way that Ole Miss should be able to get their playoff run in a favorable start. But I think if you want to go beyond that, it's going to have to be, as much as energy and motivation can carry you, I think the start looking ahead down the bracket, I'm not really worried about the offense. I think what could hold them up is like if the rush defense, it's 13th in the SEC, you run into Georgia, you get into a situation where, okay, if you play Ohio State, they haven't been the greatest running the ball either, but they also still have a lot of talent in their backfield too. So that may be one thing. And the other one is scoring touchdowns in the red zone, 13th in the SEC in red zone offense at touchdown percentage. That's something on Saturday where you could easily see, okay, if Ole Miss is kicking field goals and they're allowing Tulane to hang around, all of a sudden we get a four-quarter game instead of the 45-10 blowout that we saw the first time.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now I'm waiting for this one because they're going head-to-head. So I didn't even know how to tackle this one, Stephen. But let's start with Oklahoma, because I'm just giving them the edge because they're at home and they're the higher seed. What is the path for Oklahoma to go all the way and win it all?
Defense. You know, it's got to be, Mike, this defense is good enough to win a national championship. I really believe that anybody they face in the playoff, they are good enough on defense to more than hold their own. The question is going to be, as good as this defense is, and you know, we saw it at the end of the regular season, LSU with a very sluggish offense nearly won and cost them a playoff spot. You're going to face better offenses as you go in the playoff, and it's going to start on Friday, you know, with Alabama, and even down the road, potentially Indiana in the Rose Bowl, Texas Tech, Oregon. As good as this defense is, I think it can carry them a long way. If they do not find a way to get 10 to 15 more percent better on offense since the end of the season, it will be difficult to win round one. It will certainly be very difficult to beat Indiana in the Rose Bowl.
Yeah. So they're going to. Now, having said that, though, Steven, I mean, maybe they can be even more opportunistic on defense in terms of maybe, I mean, we'll take all the points we can get on defense, but yeah. to rely on that would be difficult. But maybe not even that. Maybe it's field position. Maybe it's forcing turnovers to give your offense a short field. And with the best kicker in the country, maybe you win a couple games, 9-7, 9-6. Yeah. But, you know, again, one player here or there. This is going to sound crazy, Stephen, because, again, we're talking trying to win a national championship here, right? But it's almost, to me, it feels like if Oklahoma plays mistake-free on offense, even if they're not scoring, which they'll have to score a little, obviously, but almost like if every possession ends in a kick, I feel like Oklahoma can win whoever they're playing against.
I think that's 100% right. I was just thinking that myself. Is if you're Oklahoma and you don't have like -2, -3 in the turnover column, and every game is just like a grind it out, like 17-13 kind of game, like Brent Venables has said this time, you know, it's not pretty. That is A-okay. Like, it is just fine to win with defense. It does not have to be a 31-30 kind of shootout. But, you know, Mike, you also think about that, and you think about Indiana. The Rose Bowl is January 1st. It's about a month since they played last. I mean, I did think last year in the Rose Bowl, Oregon looked a little rusty in the first half, and certainly, like, they kind of found their groove, like, when the game was way out of hand. You do wonder about some of these teams, like, and I think because of the seeding change, you know, the fact that it's now top four teams and not just conference champions, I wonder if that stat from last year that those bye week teams, they all lost, I wonder if that'll be different this year. But I think if you're Oklahoma and if you're Alabama, it's like, if you can win this game, maybe Indiana's a little rusty. Got the Heisman Trophy winner. You know, Heisman Trophy winners have been up and down and historically in bowl games and in postseason. This defense is going to travel. So just don't make the mistakes. Don't give them short fields. Let your defense force the short fields. Turn those into touchdowns, 50-yard bombs by Tate Sandell. And all of a sudden, it may seem crazy. A lot of games could be 17-13, 20-17. And all of a sudden, this defense could carry Oklahoma a couple games into the playoff.
Yeah, and who knows? But I mean, maybe this time off has allowed John Mateer's hand to heal up if it needs to be. I mean, he's not used as an excuse, but maybe he needed the time off. You know, the running backs, certainly they need them. R. Mason Thomas, I don't know if he'll play or not, but you know, the more rest, the better, I would imagine, for a lot of these ailing and. We could say that literally the same thing for Alabama, but we're focused on the Sooners here. You know, again, maybe just a handful of big plays that could be the difference between Oklahoma beating an Indiana, an Ohio State, a Georgia, whoever.
It also, we could use what happened in the Big Ten Championship as a guide, because it was a grinded out kind of game. Like, as good as Indiana is on offense, and one of the reasons they've improved from being just a playoff team to number one is what they've done in the trenches. But that was a kind of, every play was a struggle in the Big Ten Championship game. So if Indiana had trouble moving the ball consistently against Ohio State, you can go to the Oklahoma and say, this defense is just as good as Ohio State is. So all of a sudden you're kind of like, all right, that game played out. If we make the three or four plays, we can win this game. I do think Oregon's going to benefit a lot from the time off because they were so banged up at receiver at the end of the year. I think Oklahoma will also benefit too, because I do think there are some plays you see with Mateer. It's like, it's open. He's got to hit it. It's a consistency thing, but there are also things where maybe the thumb is bothering him, that time off to heal, get away from, you know, the grind of the season. Maybe that'll help getting back on track. So I think Oklahoma's offense, while it may not be way more prolific, I think it'll just benefit from having a chance to kind of step back, get healthy, and hit the reset button maybe here or there, and that helps them on Friday, and if they win, going beyond that.
Yeah. All right, and then let's flip it to the other side, Stephen. Alabama, again, I don't know how many people realize this, Steven, but a week ago, or I guess slightly over a week ago, they were the number one seed in the SEC, Steven. Now, a 28-7 loss will, you know, put a dent in that reputation. But nonetheless, they were the number one seed in the SEC championship game and in regular season. And now they're going into a playoff. And heck, they're favored, Steven. They're a slight favorite on the road. And they're as talented as anybody. And their coach, he may be boring, but he is a big game coach. And if Ty Simpson, I don't know what's wrong with him, but if we can get that resolved, you know, he's been as dangerous as anybody. Thoughts on Alabama and what is the path for the Crimson Tide to make a big run here and perhaps win the national championship?
This is a big picture thought, Mike, but I almost believe that the path to for the national championship has to start with Alabama still has one of the highest roster talents in the country. Ohio State, Georgia, Alabama coming into the year. I think if you just looked at raw roster data, those are the three most talented rosters on paper. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to make a run, but I think what I'm getting at is the ingredients are there. And Alabama's defense has held 7 of its last 9 opponents under 350 total yards. And I think what's happened offensively is kind of overshadowed that, hey, this defense is pretty good. And then you look at that loss to Oklahoma a few weeks ago. They outgained Oklahoma by almost 200 yards. They just lost, like, the 4 to 5 big plays all went in Oklahoma's favor. So I think if you want to kind of reset this for Alabama, it's pretty simple to me. They, after losing that game to Florida State, we saw the real kind of Alabama team going through that grind of the season. Maybe they just ran out of steam late in the year, but they also survived it. And now they've had a chance to kind of reset since the SEC championship game. They've had a week to maybe get healthy. Maybe Ty Simpson could kind of maybe was a little bit banged up. They got a chance here to reset. So I think roster talent, little bit of time to heal up. And that should start with getting the offense back on track, because they have not scored 30 points since they played Tennessee on October 18th. And for as much, you know, against an FBS opponent, I should say, take away the Eastern Illinois game, this offense was humming in the early parts of the season. And since they've kind of bogged down a little bit. So it just feels like to me the defense, and especially on Friday, the defense is going to keep them in it. For Friday's game and beyond, if you can make couple plays offensively and get this group back on track, it's still all there for Alabama to make a run in the playoff. I don't know if they necessarily are this year's Ohio State, but it feels like somebody's going to be that, whether it's Texas A&M, Alabama, Oklahoma. One of these SEC teams, I think, is going to make a run. And maybe it's Alabama if they can get back on track offensively.
Well, it sounds to me, Stephen, like Tim Banks just softened Bama up for the rest of them. Right. And everybody just worked off his playbook. But, yeah, no, I think all kidding aside, what you just hit on there is important. Yeah, this is – there could be a team that's going to make a run. And at midway through the season, if you would have asked me to – put the mortgage on a team from the SEC winning it all, this would have been my team here. Now, a lot's happened since then, but I think because we're so one-dimensional, and shout out the cousin, he's said it like 9 times in the comments. We get it. They didn't run the ball against Georgia, but -3. But they got to have Ty Simpson get over whatever he's dealing with, whether he's injured or whether he's in his head, I don't know. But he's got to get over that, because I think we can only go as far as Ty Simpson can take us this year because we're so one-dimensional on offense. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I do. So I think 2 things are true here. I do think Alabama has to run the ball a little bit better to win the national championship. And a little bit is they don't have to get to 200 yards. They just have to have a little bit of a threat to take some of the pressure off of Ty Simpson. But, Mike, I do also wonder – if maybe now that we're in the playoff, it's like, just screw it. we can't run the ball. We're not even going to try. And I don't want to say like you go full, like, you know, air raid or, you know, run and shoot back in the day, but your best chance to win this game is Ty Simpson, Ryan Williams, Jeremy Bernard, Isaiah Horton, and looks like Josh Quavis might be back. Like, you've got the weapons, like, spread them out, let Ty Simpson throw it, because they got to have some balance. But to me, like, this team will go as Ty Simpson goes, because their defense is going to keep them in it. If they could play mistake free ball, Simpson gets back on track. There's your path to winning on Friday and winning beyond this. If Alabama wants to make a run, the national championship again, because, you know, Mike, you said it back in the middle of the season. I think if you asked me at one point, I probably would have said Alabama's probably the team that's from the SEC that's going to make it. Even back in the preseason, people predicted Alabama to win the national championship. And it wasn't just like one or two people. There were quite a few. So they've got the roster talent. How it all comes together with this little bit of time and some of the question marks is going to be an interesting question.
Yeah. And does it concern you at all, though, Stephen? Because maybe I think it has concerned me at times, and I think maybe it's just come to fruition here, but it seems like anytime we have a short yardage situation and we're Alabama, we're having to bust out a trick play or a reverse, or we got to throw it to the left tackle, or, you know, it's always got to be some kind of gimmicky something or other. And it looks cool and it's a fun story. And wow, how many tricks that Bama staff got up their sleeve, until we realize, well, maybe they're doing all that because they don't have another option. I mean, I think the last month has probably shown us maybe they don't have any other options.
So you're saying that the short yards playbook of Caden Proctor, Jeremy Bernard, or the fake pitch or the pitch to the receiver in motion that Ryan Grubb and Kalen DeBoer have used about 100 times in key situations might need some tweaks before we get to the playoff, right? You might need a few more tricks, right?
And every time they run a 2-point conversion, which is not that often, admittedly, but it's like we got to put six guys in motion, and sometimes Ty's not even taking the snap. It's like he's that running back. It's like, because my God, I guess they got a good offensive line, don't they? I don't understand it, but maybe they don't.
That offensive line will be under fire quite a bit. I mean, you speak about, you know, Friday's game against Oklahoma, but let's just say they do win that game. You know, Indiana's got a good defensive front. You think about Texas Tech or Oregon, like, your path to the national championship has got to start with good offensive line play. So the Caden Proctor, the Parker Brailsford, like, the high profile guys have got to live up to the hype. They could also make a lot of money in terms of NFL draft stock if they shine over the next couple of weeks. So, you know, Mike, in a sense, it does feel like all of the parts are there for Alabama to win on Friday and make a run. But it also requires those parts to meet the sort of potential that each group has, if that makes sense. And for the last month or so, we really haven't seen an indication that it's all going to come together. Is that fair?
No, I think that's 100% fair, and that's a huge concern going into this playoff of whether Alabama can make a run or they're going to be one and done.
I do think DeBoer has been good. Obviously, when he was at Washington, they won the semifinal against Texas, and, you know, they lost to Michigan in the national championship. Not a surprise; they were an underdog. But it does feel like his teams, I know they didn't play well in the SEC championship game, but it does feel like when kind of backs against the wall, underdog a bit, you know, I kind of joke, big game to boring. It does feel like there might be a few things that they have cooked up for Friday night, and maybe even beyond that, trying to get this team back on track.
Hey, let me ask you the same thing I asked Marler earlier today. I'm just kind of curious where you go. Let's omit Georgia, because that's kind of the obvious answer. So we're just looking at the SEC teams that are playing in the opening round. We've got Alabama, of course, at Oklahoma. We've got Ole Miss facing Tulane and Texas A&M facing Miami. Which first round SEC team do you have the most confidence in winning the national championship? If I asked you that, what's your answer?
Man, that's such a great question. Is Oklahoma a crazy answer?
No, not at all. That's where Marler went.
Oh, I don't know if I should pick the same thing as Marler did, right? I think I like Texas A&M better. The problem is the bracket is harder. Maybe that's a bad way to look at it. I think if Texas A&M was in the top half, I'd like their path a little bit more. So they'd be a slam dunk easy choice. But I the reason why I kind of gravitate towards Oklahoma, Mike, is really just defense. I mean, I think this defense, you know, coming into the every playoff game, they're going to hold their opponent to, you know, whatever 20, 24 points and fewer, like just draw the line. And so if you can scratch off enough offensively, this defense is good enough to win a national title. And if you can figure this out offensively, I think you got a good chance to make a run. Maybe Oklahoma ends up being the team that wins a couple games here that most people don't expect. So I would probably lean Oklahoma because of defense, and I feel like the path is easier on that side. I think A&M is probably the most complete team, and I just think the bracket's a little bit harder, getting Miami and then potentially Ohio State.
Okay. Let me just for funsies here, Steven, let's go through this game by game. How many points will it take for Oklahoma to beat Alabama? Ballpark, where if we could guarantee you Oklahoma scores X amount of points, Steven Lassen said, oh, they're beating Alabama.
I think I feel good about 24, but wouldn't you also think they could win this game with just 20?
Yeah, I think so against Alabama. Now, same question against Indiana. Oklahoma at Indiana. If Oklahoma scores X amount, how confident are you they beat Indiana?
It took Indiana 13 points to beat Ohio State. It took them 20 to beat Iowa. I think if you're Oklahoma, you get to 24, you probably feel good about yourselves. Am I crazy?
No, not at all. But let's keep the game going, Steven. So Oregon or Texas Tech? Whoever you think most likely is there, I guess. I guess Oklahoma. How many points would it take Oklahoma to beat Oregon or Texas Tech?
I think you kind of go to that same range, maybe like 24, 27. I'd say 24 seems about right for Indiana, and it also feels about right for Texas Tech or Oregon. I think Indiana is probably just as good off, if not better, than both of those teams.
Okay. And then we're already in the, I don't even know where the national, is it in Miami this year?
Yeah, it's in Miami Gardens.
All right, we're down in Miami, Steven. We got the Sooners versus, let's just say, Georgia or Ohio State. And I'm just saying that because they're largely the betting favorites to get there. So if they got to face Georgia or Ohio State, how many points for Oklahoma to win the Natty?
Well, Mike, let's go back in the archives. 2001. Oklahoma 13-2 beating Florida State for the national championship. So, I think they'll probably need a little bit more than that, but I think you're kind of in that 20-24 range. I mean, I think Georgia would be content to play a 20-17 kind of game. I think Ohio State can maybe stress you a little bit more offensively in the passing game downfield. So you maybe bump it up a bit to like 24, but you know, kind of as we're talking here, it does feel like 27 sort of feels like the right range here for Oklahoma.
Okay, so all we need, I'm trying to do the math right now, is how many field goals would that be? Six, seven?
Yeah.
Seven, tape.
Did you say
tape,
six, seven?
Yeah. Oh, God, don't start that. That's all we need. Or one John Mateer touchdown and four or five field goals, and Oklahoma can win it all, huh?
I mean, if you look at the season kind of stats for Oklahoma, the last time that they scored over 30 points was against Tennessee, and then the time before that was Kent State. When they play most power conference opponents, it's been about 24 or so points. So you're right. I mean, score once on defense, kick a bunch of long field goals, a long John Mateer pass to Satanga or Deion Burks, and you're set. That's easier said than done, but there's your kind of big play path for Oklahoma to get to 24.
Okay, so, man, everybody's high on the Sooners going in to the college football playoff. I'm sure they'll appreciate that, all their fans, even though there's been a lot of people in, like, national media says they don't even belong in the field, those crazy sons of guns. But I think it's mostly Ralph Russo, who I always thought he did a good job, but I never got his Sooner hate. I never understood that.
I mean, I guess the alternative would be put Notre Dame or Texas. I mean, those would be kind of your first two candidates to go in the field. Oklahoma's got better wins, you know, tougher strength of schedule, right? They kind of earned their way into the field. I know, and I think part of it is a beauty contest. I mean, Oklahoma's games are ugly at times. 17-6, 17-13. That's okay. Defense can win national championships. And if they can get maybe the John Mateer that showed up in September to go with a great defense, you got something, right?
No doubt. But we got to see it on the field, Steven. And that's what will be so fascinating to see starting Friday night here with the college football playoff. Steven will be back on Wednesday to make his predictions for the playoffs. So we'll go even, you know, on a deeper dive on all these matchups. Can't wait for that. But before we end this one, Steven, I would like to honor the great cousins that have donated memberships, like Tate Gunna. Tate, what a name. He gifted 5 memberships. Steven, Joe B. 1, Dallas Smith, Texas, Adrian Ergon Gernold. I hope I probably butchered that. The American Idiot, shout out Shane. Tallow Wolf, and then the JR, the legend, he's gifted a membership. Shout out JR.
The legend, cousin JR, has done it again.
He gifted Coach Mitch, and then we had All Day Trey. He gifted Keg 2071, and then another legend, Steven Up. We love all Stevens on this
always
channel.
Showing up for them boys in Tuscaloosa. It's Steven Up. Roll Tide.
He gifted Crayons. All of y'all, welcome to
the family.
Yay. All right, Steven, anything else before we hop off here?
Mike, I was going to ask you, is Oklahoma-Alabama the playoff game you are anticipating or most eager to see this week?
I think for me, believe it or not, is A&M Miami.
Yeah.
Because I want to see if my belief that A&M is one of the better teams in the country, if that's validated, or maybe the haters are right, Steven. I never root for the haters, but there's A&M's got a lot of haters, and the haters think A&M is cakewalk through an easy schedule. And if they lose to Miami, I think it would be fair to say maybe the haters are right this time.
Just going to put the warning flag out for you and Shane that Miami's got a lot of fans on the internet. They don't always go to the games, but they got a lot of fans on the internet. So just going to warn you guys, if things start going south, you might want to end any kind of live show or stream or recap show. So,
yeah, I'm trying to think, Steven, you know, because there's a lot of losers out there. Notre Dame tops probably the list. Florida State fans are pretty awful, too. But, you know, what I find is kind of the most hilariously awful is Central Florida fans, which I wouldn't even think they'd have fans. But going back to shout out Danny White, he does a good job at Tennessee now, but he's the man responsible for their mythical, 2019 national championship. Man, those people came out the woodwork for years. You know what?
So is that the SEC podcast most disliked fan base right now is UCF?
They're up there, but no, it's probably Notre Dame. I mean, those guys are idiots, and it's somewhere in there. Miami, Florida State. Yeah, I guess I don't care for the whole state of Florida except for Gator people. You know.
Have you seen Notre Dame's 2026 schedule, by the way?
I haven't, but I bet it's gloriously awful.
Let me read it to you. try not to be overwhelmed here. Wisconsin in Green Bay, Lambeau Field. That's pretty cool. Rice, Michigan State, Purdue, North Carolina, Navy, Miami. That's a good one. Boston College, SMU, Syracuse, Stanford, and USC.
What a joke.
It might break a sweat in like two games next year.
So they'll go 11-1 and guaranteed to get in. You know what?
Yeah, I think they are probably going to start top 10 next year pretty easily.
And if they go 12-0, they'll probably be number one without deserving it.
Yeah, and I think we talked about this before, but they're kind of guaranteed in the playoff now next year with the new agreement that if they make with the top 12, they'll be in the playoff. Now, the committee could kind of strategically place them at 13 or 14 if they wanted to. But if that schedule's, it's going to take a lot to go wrong for them to get in there. And which it also, comparing that to some of these 9-game SEC slates, it does kind of set alarm bells off in my mind about how do we evaluate some of these teams in the playoff after this year's disaster, and then going forward, how do we fix some of these things?
Who agreed to that? Why are we? I mean, does Alabama get the same treatment? You know, why are we doing that for Notre Dame?
Mike, that is a very good question. It is a very good question as to why that was a provision. I'm guessing largely because it's very hard to get all these people to agree to one thing. So they kind of, in order to get them on board with this, we gave them this. Also, think big picture here, because if you're the SEC or Big Ten, if you're the Big Ten, you don't want Notre Dame to go to the SEC and say, hey, we'll play 6 games with you guys, because that hurts the Big Ten. And if you're the SEC, you don't want Notre Dame to go to the Big Ten and leave the ACC and have that same kind of agreement. I don't know if they would, but sometimes it's almost better if they're just an independent over here and not affiliated with the Big Ten. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, in some sense that I get it, but Dale, let the Big Ten have them. I don't care. Now what? The Big Ten will have 4 good teams instead of 3. You know what?
I think Notre Dame would be an enjoyable addition as far as let them play 6 games against some of these SEC teams, right?
Yeah, and let them go 7-5 every year. You know what?
Let Notre Dame. I mean, they've played at Oklahoma before. They played at Tennessee. I mean, I'd love to see some Notre Dame, Alabama, Notre Dame, Georgia series. And I know some of these are on the books, but that would be way more. They would earn their way into the playoff a lot more than just play the Syracuse and Stanford's of the world.
Luck of the Irish get you nothing in the Southeastern Conference. I can promise you that, Stephen. I think that's a good place to end it. I appreciate you, Stephen, as always, and being flexible. I know you got to run. So, hey, we'll be back tomorrow with Cousin Shane. Until normal time, as always, 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central. Until then, we'll catch you on the next one. We appreciate you guys. Bye-bye.
Hey, buddy. This beer's for you, Mike, and Cousin Shane. That SEC podcast loves the pirate, and the pirate loves that SEC podcast. Hail State.